Center, you are most welcome. I see the Paralegal Association of South Africa is not here. I don't know whether they have been intimidated by the caliber of other people, because it appears that the more we're trying to move forward together, the more we move apart from one another. When this committee was dealing with the legal practice bill, we were given some assurances that we shouldn't deal with paralegal legislation. It will be dealt with at a later stage. But at this late stage, there doesn't seem to be some enthusiasm or support for it. I attended a continental conference in Kigali where the Chief Justice attended, Chief Justices from other jurisdictions in Africa attended, Judge President Mulambo attended. I didn't see anybody from the National Bar Council of South Africa. I don't know whether that was an indication that you don't take paralegal sector seriously, because we are always saying that we need to ensure that there is access to justice by the ordinary people, because unless we ensure access to justice by ordinary people, we are going to have our institutions being rejected by our people, because they will think that these institutions are irrelevant. So I think that the question of paralegal legislation, access to justice, cannot be left to paralegals. We need all the brains that we have in the country to help us find solutions, because we are trying to build one South Africa. So I hope that after this process of amendment, we will see the Bar Council also helping us to develop legislation as quickly as possible, so that we get the paralegal legislation finalized, so that access to justice can become a reality. Now, the first presenter here is Mr. Andre. That's Paris. Okay, from the National Bar Council of South Africa. You are welcome. And I can see that you are in the company of a high-powered team. So we are looking forward to a very constructive and good engagement. You can take the floor.
Good afternoon, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee and members, honorable members of the Portfolio Committee. I'm Andre Paris. I'm an advocate and I'm also a member of the National Bar Council. We have a three-member delegation here today. I'm joined by two founding members of the National Bar Council, Advocate De Freitas. Some jurists and some lawyers will know that surname De Freitas, and then Advocate Matthew Klein, who is our representative at the National Forum.
Does the National Bar Council include the other bar councils? Well, we have the Mzenge and other advocates for social transformation. Are you inclusive of all those? Can you educate us?
We are a bar, and we the alternative bar to the General Council of the bar. We have different branches, national family, and we are recognized by the Constitution as a registered bar to represent legal practitioners, specifically advocates who represent. It is an honor and a privilege to make these submissions on behalf of the National Bar Council of South Africa on the legal practice of Amendment Bill. In a way of introduction, the purpose of this submission to the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services is to present and make proposals on legislation which has far-reaching implications for the future of legal practitioners in South Africa. Our first submission is on the Legal Practice Amendment Bill, B11 of 2017, which is currently being considered by this committee and seeks to amend specific provisions in the Legal Practice Act 28 of 2014. And our second submission is to present motivation for the considerations for proposals for further amendments to the LPA, notwithstanding the fact that such amendments are not part of the proposed amendments of the bill before the committee. We will be asking this committee to consider Rule 249 to allow us to proceed with those that amendments, but I will address that further in the submission. Just as the background, and on page one of our submissions, when the LPA was introduced in Parliament, its memorandum on the objects highlighted that the legal profession is not representative of the demographics of South Africa. And that was a concern of the Minister of Justice as well in 2015 when he launched the National Forum. And also that entry into the profession is in many instances determined by outdated and overly restricted prescripts. Further, that access to legal services, especially by the poor, is limited. The National Bar Council of South Africa subscribes to the principle of access to justice and also ensuring healthy professional competition between legal practitioners, whether it's advocate, attorney, and also other role players such as paralegal chairperson. Now, it is critical to rely these objectives and various provisions in the Act be aligned with the Constitution. The National Bar Council of South Africa and its role in the National Forum is established in the LPA. Section 96 of the LPA established the National Forum on the Legal Profession, and the National Bar Council is represented in the National Forum and has one seat. The National Bar Council is making these submissions to the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services as an institution and represents its members nationally, who are in excess of 800 members. All these submissions are made on behalf of the National Bar Council of South Africa. Now, just to reflect on the LPA Amendment Bill, Chairperson, you will note the primary aim of the bill is to address practical and technical issues of a non-contentious nature. So there are some clauses which we will not oppose, which we view as non-contentious, but there are others that we would like to put forward submissions to for this committee to decide on. So, including the transitional provisions of the Act, the implementation of the Act is also important. In terms of Clause 1, which amends Section 6 of the Act, he's saying that the bill seeks to add as functions of the Council the establishment and promotion, administration or assistance in the establishment and promotion or administration of insurance schemes, such as also medical aid schemes, etc., and provident funds for employees of legal practitioners and for officials and employees of the Council. Our view on this amendment is non-contentious, and we give our support. Clause 2, which amends Section 2.3, subsection 2B of the Act, Section 23 of the Act provides for the establishment of provincial councils. Now, this proposed amendment will allow the minister to prescribe the areas of jurisdiction of provincial councils in consultation with the council. The National Law Council also finds this to be non-contentious and is no objection to this clause. Clause 3, which amends Section 33 of the Act, is a contentious clause which the National Law Council would like to make further argument and opinion and submissions on. It provides for the authority to render legal services. Clause 3 amends Section 33.1 and 33 subsection 3 to provide that only practicing legal practitioners may perform certain acts or render certain services by inserting the word practicing. Now, I will put to this committee later as to why the National Bar Council is contending on this proposed amendment. But let me first deal with all the other amendments which are non-contentious, Chair, if I may, and come back to those arguments on the ones that we are contending. Is that okay? Clause 4, amend Section 91 of the Act. Section 91 of the Act provides for the rights of banks in respect of trust accounts. Clause 4, amend Section 91.4 of the Act to provide that the Legal Practitioners Fidelity Fund Board may also determine the period for which a bank statement must be issued, and also the word statement will be changed with the words transaction history. This clause is also non-contentious, and the National Bar Council has no dispute regarding this amendment. Clause 5 amends Section 96 of the Act and provides for the establishment of the National Forum on the Legal Profession. Clause 5 proposes an amendment to Section 96 of the Act to provide that the National Forum ceases to exist on the date of the meeting with the Council as envisaged in Section 105.3, or such other date as the Minister may determine after consultation with the National Forum. This was clause was proposed from the beginning, and this is non-contentious, and the National Bar Council gives its support to Clause 5. Clause 6 amends Section 97 of the Act, Chairperson, which sets out the terms of reference of the National Forum. And Clause 6 proposes that the mandate of the National Forum should be broadened to include the mandate to advise the Minister on the first set of regulations that must be made in terms of Section 94 of the Act, and to make the first set of rules in terms of Section 95 of the Act. What's important here, which the National Bar Council takes note of, that there will be a set of rules and a set of regulations. And we will be watching and considering those this amendment if this committee decides that it is allowed. But this is not opposed by the National Bar Council. Clause 7 deals with the consequential amendments, Chairperson, to Section 109 of the Act, which confirm and give effect to the extension of the mandate of the National Forum as contemplated in Clause 6. It is also a non-contentious support by the National Bar Council. Clause 8 amends Section 117 of the Act, which deals with transitional provisions relating to the existing statutory law society. The amendment proposes that the existing law societies must continue to perform their powers and functions until the date of all transfer of assets, rights, liabilities, obligations, and staff from the current law societies to the council or provincial councils as contemplated in Section 92A of the Act as amended by Clause 6. This is also non-contentious, as well as the short title in Clause 9, which deals with the bill which was submitted to the National Forum on the Legal Profession with the NBCSA as a member. It is our submission that the National Bar Council of South Africa is making these submissions as a institution that represents its members. Our main concern, as I put into the Portfolio Committee Chairperson, is Section 33, and I'd like to deal with that now. As already stated, there is a proposed amendment to Section 33 of the Act, Clause 3 of the Bill, which provides that inserting the word practicing. This word practicing, our concerns are as follows, honourable members, that there is no definition in the Act for the term practicing legal practitioner. Does the term practicing legal practitioner suggest then that this term will apply only to those legal practitioners who attend or appear in court? Does the definition exclude consultants who, though render or offer various legal services, do not appear in court? Will such consultants not be entitled to receive rewards or commission for rendering legal services? In our submission to the Portfolio Committee on page 5, we have inserted the Act, and I refer the committee to page 6 of our submissions, where we say that Clause 3 of the Bill, which amends the Act, provides, subject to any other law at subsection 3A, no person other than a practicing legal practitioner who has been admitted and enrolled as such in terms of this Act may, in expectation of any fee, commission, gain or reward, and by substitution for subsection 3 of the following section, the important word is at the end of subsection 3B, unless that person is a practicing advocate, attorney, conveyancer, or notary, as the case must be. We submit, Chairperson, that the current reading of Section 33, 1 and 3 in the Act should be retained as a proposed amendment, will adversely affect other legal practitioners. Our submissions are the following: that Section 33 will create a monopoly on the rendering of legal services to a selected few. This is unnecessary, the distinction between a legal practitioner and a practicing legal practitioner. In the absence of a clear definition, it has the potential of frustrating and hampering the existence and operations of other role players in the legal fraternity, such as paralegals. Our submission is that the availability of the number of paralegals could alleviate the legal needs of low and moderate income persons. This unnecessary distinction between practicing and just a legal practitioner will result in clients paying higher than the necessary legal fees. Paralegals should be allowed to practice law on their own. It should be borne in mind that paralegals expand the availability of legal services at an acceptable cost. Because some of the work that attorneys do on a day-to-day basis, we can substitute them as functions on at a cheaper rate with paralegals. Now, the National Bar Council support the view of providing needed legal services to the poor at little or no cost to clients. Access to the legal system by the rich or poor is an essential feature of a democratic order. We also submit that it is generally accepted that the practice of law includes, but not limited to, representing others before the courts and administrative agencies, and providing legal advice or legal drafting services to others. And paralegals provide these services to the people at the minimal cost. It is also important that consumers should be protected against unscrupulous persons who may pose as legal practitioners, resulting in consumers failing, victims of possible incompetence and dishonesty. Besides legal practitioners, if we consider other legal role players such as advisors in the CCMA, to what extent are they considered when we include or insert this term practicing before in the definition of practicing legal practitioner? So a reflection on the provisions which are not part of the proposed amendments in the bill is what I would like to proceed to now, Chairperson. And I'm asking the Portfolio Committee to consider Rule 2491 of the Assembly Rules that provides if a bill has been published for public comment in terms of section or in terms of Rule 241 or 248, the Assembly Committee to which the bill is referred must arrange its business in such a manner that interested persons and institutions have an opportunity to comment on the bill. In the same vein, Rule 2493 of the Assembly Rules provide that the committee must inquire into the subject of the bill and report on it to the Assembly. Very important, subsection B. If it is a bill amending the provisions of the legislation, Chairperson, you may seek permission of the Assembly to inquire into amending other provisions of that legislation. We would like to direct this committee's attention to Section 34.2b of the LPA, which reads as follows: an advocate contemplated in paragraph A, subsection Roman numeral 2, may only render those legal services rendered by advocates before the commencement of this act as determined by the council in the rules if he or she is in possession of a Fidelity Fund certificate and conducts his or her practice in accordance with the relevant provisions of Chapter 7, with particular reference to Section 84, 85, 86, and 87, and has notified the Council thereof in terms of Section 31B, Roman numeral 2. The question which we would like to put to the Portfolio Committee is, will advocates who possess a Fidelity certificate be permitted to perform those functions which are performed by attorneys? Is the construction of Section 34 aligned to what the Act seeks to achieve? In our view, it is not. Our reading of Section 34 is premised on the following. A, and I'm on page 9 of my submissions now, Chairperson, I'm nearly done. An advocate who will possess a Fidelity Fund certificate will render those services which were traditionally rendered by advocates before the commencement of the Act. Simply put, these advocates referred to here in above will not perform functions of an attorney, even though they are both in possession of a Fidelity Fund certificate. So why give African Fidelity Fund certificate if they cannot be on the same footing as others who possess the Fidelity Fund certificate? Before the commencement of the Act, advocates did not sign notices or pleadings in the court. They were not allowed to. The question is this what the Act intends to achieve, where litigants who approach Fidelity Fund advocates will still be required or expected to have notices or pleadings drafted? So even if I am granted a Fidelity Fund certificate, do I still have to approach an attorney if I want to put pleadings or sign a notice of motion to the court? That would mean I would now incur more costs for my client, because he's paying me as an advocate who has the Fidelity Fund certificate, yet I must still contract an attorney and build that into the fee which will be charged to client. Why is that necessary? Is this not an instance where we can really look at cutting costs to the man in the street, to the clients in the street? So, we are saying that it is our submission that it is not as we believe that the client is necessary to remunerate both the advocate with a Fidelity Fund certificate and an attorney. Why are advocates with a Fidelity Fund certificate not recognized by the Act in the same manner with attorneys who possess the same Fidelity Fund? We therefore propose that Section 34.2b should be amended to read as follows. An advocate contemplated in paragraph A, 2, may render legal services as determined by the counsel in the rules if he or she is in possession of a Fidelity Fund certificate and conducts his or her practice in accordance with the relevant provisions of Chapter 7. With particular reference to Section 84, 85, 86, and has notified the counsel thereof in terms of Section 31b2. Our proposed amendment is premised on some historical considerations as well as recent development in the practice of law in our country. Firstly, it is common cause that the practice of law, and specifically the advocate profession in South Africa, was borrowed from English system, and as such, the traditions... Mr. Chairperson, I'm nearly done. Secondly, it is common cause that traditionally in England and Wales, where the South African system is borrowed from, barristers cannot generally be instructed by members of the public without being instructed by a solicitor. Thirdly, it is common cause that the development in the 21st century revolutionized the legal profession in the UK and Wales with the introduction of a public access scheme. This is commonly known as PALS, enabling barristers to accept instructions directly from clients without the intervention of a solicitor, which in UK is equivalent to an attorney in South Africa or other intermediary. Fourth, it is a known fact that in terms of the public access scheme, members of the public are also allowed to brief a barrister without the intervention of a solicitor. Further, there are well-established protocols how this is achieved and how the principle of the best interest of the client as well as the interest of justice are promoted under the scheme. It is our submission that the current legislation which refers to an advocate before the Act is not in the best interest of the client as well as in the interest of justice. It will just inflate legal costs in South Africa. And one of the main reasons why the National Bar Council emphasizes the Legal Practice Council to determine those services should be rendered by advocates envisaged in section 34(2)(b), and also the deletion of the provision that advocates refer to in section 34(b) may only render those services rendered by advocates before the commencement of the Act is premised on the following. If the current reading of section 34(2)(b) is retained, the Legal Practice Council will not be able to revolutionize the scope and the ambit of services of advocates. Thank you, Chairperson. Also, the South African legal system will not be open to the public, and it will not be easy and cheaper for the South African consumers to obtain legal advice, thereby saving on legal costs. We ask this committee to consider the provisions of Rule 249 of the National Assembly Rules and consider this submission. In conclusion, we are of the view that in order to make legal services accessible and cheaper to the public, an investigation on the form and content of the public access scheme should be conducted. Such an investigation should also focus on the guidelines for lay clients who instruct advocates directly and guidelines for advocates who are briefed directly by clients. In conclusion, then, finally, it's our submission that in order to realize the true spirit and purpose of the Constitution, and more particularly the underlying principle enshrined in the Bill of Rights, the committee considers the proposed amendments.
Thank you, Advocate. You know, we are public representatives, and the public include millions of young people who are saying we must decolonize the law. How do we explain to them why you would jump the whole of Africa and go to England and Wales, and there's no mention of what is happening on the continent? And I remember in the 80s, Zimbabwe here was dealing with the fusion of the bar and sidebar. Namibia were dealing with the fusion of bar and sidebar. Are you saying there's nothing to learn from Africa?
Yes, I agree that the minister should consult and he should be accountable. However, it is so that we must also be able to, as a legal profession, within our rules and in our legislation, make provision that when we present, or when there's co-governance with the minister, that there are certain ideals which we entrench in the proposed legislation, which not make it difficult for us to transform meaningfully.
If there's no agreement between you and the minister, does it mean that the minister must stop ruling as mandated by the people? Doesn't it mean that you have veto powers over government and minister that is in elected by the people?
That is indeed so. I would agree with that.
Okay, Honourable Members, there's a clear, straightforward presentation, and I open the floor. Honourable Bongo.
Just, Chair, as a matter of housekeeping, I just want to know how is it related, the National Bar Council of South Africa and the National Forum of Legal Profession. What is the relationship there?
We are one of the
bars that's recognized by the Department of Justice, and we've been afforded representation on the National Forum of the Legal Profession. So we do have representation. We have one seat on that forum.
And also your delegation, if it's one delegation, that is, doesn't speak to the demographics of the country. Now, can you explain why that would be so? Because you know, ordinary people have been in the process of transforming this country for 20 years. But it would seem that lawyers who make laws, who drafted the Constitution, are the slowest in the transformation process. So can we, I just want us to be on the same page. I'm not accusing you of anything.
Yes, if I may respond to that, it is indeed so that our bar is representative of all races, and we have membership in different parts of the country, rural and urban areas, and that if you consider the demographics of our bar, we're actually more previously disadvantaged than from advantage background. And most of our practitioners, they do work for the Legal Aid Board as in-service employees or as judicare practitioners. So we represent a good mix of legal practitioners from different backgrounds.
That good mix must be reflected here in the delegation.
Yeah, I agree with you, Chairperson. We received very short notice that we will be allowed to present our submission, and our Chairperson could not make it today, and we do have other people who are already committed to court cases and to other schedules. So we apologize for that, but indeed so. If the Chairperson considers our website, you'll be able to see the healthy mix that I referred to.
Honorable member?
The floor is open, and I recognize Honorable Short, Honorable Mutapo, Honorable Mpumulwana, Honorable Bongo, Honorable Hall.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for your presentation. I'm just trying to understand the body. When we did the act, there was the independent bar. So I presume this is the similar body now. And what I'm trying to ascertain is these submissions that you're making now, did you make them at that stage as well? That's the first point. Because there's a vast difference. You remember now, at that time the big issue was whether advocates should be able to get briefed directly from the public. And there was a massive concern. In the negotiations, there's still unhappiness, but that was allowed in terms of the Act,
yes.
On condition that you had a Fidelity Fund certificate. Now, the issue is, you've got representation on the forum. The forum has made a presentation as well. So, I presume the forum does not support your submission on this basis. On the issue of, and maybe you can clarify that.
Yes.
On the issue of you doing attorney's work. You see, the problem with that suggestion is that whilst I can understand the saving of costs should you sign pleadings, but for you to say you want to do attorney's work across the board, you're reopening the whole battle between the advocates and attorneys that have gone on for so long. So your suggestion needs to be much narrower. If you say you want to do attorney's work, then are you prepared to do 2 years' articles in the board exam? That's at the moment where we are, you see.
Yes,
so
I understand your question.
So it's a very narrow issue.
The honorable member
to
speak to that.
So I think that's the key challenge for me in that suggestion. You need to narrow what you're talking about when you say advocates with a Fidelity Fund certificate should be allowed to do attorney's work. But the suggestion itself, we are under pressure to finalize this bill because of the time constraints. You know it's got to be in place by February. Now, your suggestion for an additional amendment, and it applies to other submissions as well that are going beyond the bill that's tabled before us, is in terms of our rules, as you correctly mentioned, we then have to go back to Parliament. Parliament's not sitting for another 3-4 weeks to get a resolution to entertain further amendments. And it could well be that we are crowded out, that we won't be able to pass the urgent amendment that is required for the forum and the council to deal with its narrow issues. So I think you've got a number of challenges, but I appreciate the input that you've made, but I'd like you to particularly hear you on the issue of narrowing what you mean by doing attorney's work. And then second, I'd like your comments. You were very quick to concede to the chairman about in consultation with the minister. Now, in consultation means consensus. And we had those debates with the Act, and we from the opposition had major concerns about the powers being given to the minister at that time and the impact it has on the independence of the legal profession as such. And I think that was one of the reasons why we voted against the bill. So I'd like you to comment as a legal practitioner on what you see as the independence of the legal profession. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Chair, for touching on issue of demographics and representation in terms of delegation. I'm a bit concerned, Chairperson, because the National Bar Council, as well as the Law Society of South Africa and Attorney's Fidelity Fund, all these are constituent members of National Legal Forum. I thought maybe procedurally they were supposed to have made presentations to the forum. And then much time be given to Paralegal Association of South Africa, because the impact is mostly on paralegals. So, Chairperson, I'm really a bit worried about this, because it will appear it will be a double dipping. At the same time, they are represented that side, and this side they are also coming. So may I have clarity on that, with due respect. I'll take it where Honorable Bongo left it.
And in addition to that, to say that other people have challenges, they must be in court, referring to the paralegals that are working for Legal Aid South Africa, I think it's not convincing, because it is those paralegals whose experience we need to hear about. Okay.
Honorable Dumoulin?
Yes. I think contrary to my colleagues here, I quite appreciate what this concern of Section 34(2)(b). It's like giving somebody a ball, a tennis ball, and a bat, and say, "Don't come into this tennis court." What's the point of having that? If we identify the difference, which was traditionally done by the English reign in their system, would we have somebody with a solicitor, and you have an advocate now? If you liberate that people from that particular division, then is the name called legal practitioner. We can do anything, but the question is that we have to protect the public by having a fiduciary certificate. Otherwise, there will be no difference between the two. If I don't want to have a fidelity certificate, I will not keep monies from the for the public. I don't need a trust account and so on. And I just want to be free. But I want to practice as a legal practitioner, and I want to take people's money. Then I get a fidelity certificate. The question is now, this is why the Act was made. Basically to liberate the legal practice. So you don't get that particular thing of wearing wigs even if you're in Nigeria. So you are trying to liberate.
Let's not make disparaging
remarks about sister countries.
Well, I'm saying where you are in Africa in a hot place. Now, I'm saying that the system of government, which was basically, traditionally English, he is being liberated by this particular act. Here the question is it properly liberated? And that is the key thing, is that you are saying that, okay, let's liberate, let people be equal. You have two types of legal practitioners, one who is going to deal with the public and must have a certificate. Or the one who doesn't care about that, but will keep money. Now, this one says, here are advocates who now have got a fidelity certificate, who must act like attorneys, but they must not act like attorneys. There are certain things that we must do. The attorneys are still, I mean, it's surely we are not liberating the system by doing that. We need that Swat was saying that it is too late. We cannot rush this and so on. I'm listening to what he's saying. The key thing here, which we must determine, whether it is correct to keep that or not. And I say that we need to find way of doing it, but we cannot give somebody a right, and thereafter, that right cannot be exercised.
Because you are defending them, why don't you reserve your comments for our deliberations as a committee, and then...
I'm not defending them. I'm not defending them. I thought that the question that we need to find out is for clarification. So I'm saying that if I am wrong, that this is my impression. If my impression is wrong, they can say, or other people can say, sorry. Thank you.
Honorable Bongo.
Thank you, Chair. I think, part of the responsibility that Parliament has is to, as you always say, Chair, that you represent the public. That goes with us having not been... We don't need to be confusing the public and also confusing ourselves. That's why I raised a point earlier that as part of housekeeping, the presentations, you see all the presentations here will come from people who are in the legal fraternity. And I have an interest of knowing what are other views. Because what we have raised, particularly ourselves as the ruling party, was that we need a thoroughgoing revolutionary transformation in the sector of the judiciary. That has been our resolution, and we will not be able to do that if we are not getting one voice, one system from the sector itself. And we can't speak with many voices. And from where I'm sitting, Chair, I think I will be interested to know how do we liberate the whole system? Where does it come from that an advocate and an attorney all of a sudden we're writing different, one, we're writing different exams. Now, if we want to be an advocate, there's what we call side bar advocate, this non-practicing, then there's what we call those that are practicing. The side bar advocates, they get into the role on the basis that they have certain qualification only. But these ones who are at the bar, they must go and take the 6 months or 8 months training. Then on the attorney side, you must either go to a law school for 6 months, and then you write the board, and 1 year practice. If you don't do so, you must take the full 2 years. So that shows a disarray. It shows a high level of imbalance in the legal fraternity itself. And I'm sure it's the reason why also, Chair, we'll have so many voices from the fraternity. I think Parliament, whether the time is right or whether we're going to have time and so on, but Parliament must take a view that we need to standardize the issues in the legal fraternity. If we're saying we have the qualification that we have, the 4-year qualification, then you must write a board exam, then it must be equal from the attorney, it must be equal from the advocate. So what I'm generally agreeing with the concept of standardizing everything. We can't define in the act that this is practicing, this is non-practicing, and so on. We're actually creating a divide in the sector. So I'm interested, Chair, in hearing what would be a contribution? Because I ask whether they're part of the forum, and if you are part of the forum, why don't you converse these things in the forum? So that when you come here, we have consolidated, you tell Parliament what must happen on the ground, what is in the interest of the majority of the people. Generally, I take it's a revolution that we must get into. The legal fraternity must be radically transformed in a sense that it, like now, earlier on we're taking a presentation, Jay, you must have seen the earlier presentation. The other one is an expert on maritime related issues. Those other ones, they don't know the subject. He brought a very interesting point which would have had unintended consequences in the law and so on. But the others are also presenting, they don't see that. It is informed by the very fact that we must standardize everything. If we're a legal practitioner, we're a legal practitioner, and we must be able to be treated at the same level. So if we must get into it. I mean, if this is an opportunity to get into it, I don't think we'll have to use time. Immediately Parliament sees, we must be able to attend to some of those issues that are creating an imbalance in the fraternity itself. I'll stop there, but I will be interested to ask at the end what would others say? Why are we not seeing it the same way as advocates and attorneys? Why are we not consolidating and speak with one voice? Or are we just speaking as individuals that you know, just looking at your own person, your family? Because the sector must speak in one voice. We must consolidate and transform the sector once and for all. Thank you, Chairperson.
In addition, if we transform once and for all, in university councils, students sit in the university councils and they make very good inputs which take South Africa forward. Why can't in this forum, why can't we have law student councils sitting? Because they are the future and we are making all these things for the future. So I want to agree with Honorable Bongo that this forum must be inclusive. We must come and make inputs that are consulted there, because we can't make a Parliament a place where we're going to reconcile the differences between lawyers. Honorable Horn.
Thank you, Chairperson. I firstly want to align myself with the question raised by the Honorable Swart. And I think we must be advised also, if these arguments were raised in the drafting of the bill, why we should allow a rematch now? Because to my mind, for us as Parliament to allow that, there must be pressing reasons, changed circumstances. I hear what some of the other colleagues say regarding transformation of the legal profession as a whole, and maybe that could be a pressing circumstance. But then what also comes to mind is that the whole purpose and intention with the setting up of the forum was that's the institution set up by the Act to facilitate and enable transformation, and I think then the question by the Honourable Bongo as to whether the forum was canvassed and convinced as to the need for us to review this aspect, which are sought in terms of Rule 249 now, to be reviewed, whether that has indeed been done. Chair, also in respect of the comments made, in respect of inclusivity as well as the comments by the Honourable Bongo regarding some being experts, I must say that I personally will have a problem if we take the view that everything must standardise to the effect that we cannot have experts in any field anymore. Because that ultimately will also be to the detriment of the general public, in the sense that, as the English idiom says, if you're a jack of all trades, sometimes you're a master of none.
I don't know whether to be correct, but for his benefit, I don't think he understood. He's misquoting me, I think.
Let's give him the benefit of the doubt during the natural debate, then he can come back to
it. Well, I'm sorry, you must not say I said 1-2 and I did not say.
Can you correct him? Can you correct him?
Okay, Chair. Well, I did not say we standardized to a level of what people being expected. What I said, the earlier presentation brought a big disparity between what were people who were previously disadvantaged and people who were previously advantaged. That's what I meant, the disparities.
Thank you, Chair. I think the point I want to make is that if we're looking towards, for example, also regularizing paralegals and allowing paralegals to render certain forms of legal advice or legal services, the fact will be that if we are seeking standardization in all respects, that would also undermine access to justice in general and quite possibly the quality of legal services in certain respects. And I think we must carefully guard against that as well. Thank you.
Any other contribution?
Honourable Chair, Matthew Klein from the NBCSA. Just a quick one on the name change. Yes, we had to do it because we were... I congratulate the General Bar because they've given us a bad name with the word independence, so we were... it's a pity we haven't done this many, many years ago. I'm the founder of this bar. And yes, I sit on the NF, National Forum, and it is fantastic to be there. Lots of fights. You won't know how long you talk just to agree on what gown you should wear in court. So yes, the National Forum did make a rule in concept, where they will allow advocates with the Fidelity Fund to sign pleadings, etc. So that will bring us on par. But the fact is, if the General Bar Council wants to take me to court again, like they did with Mr. De Freitas 25 years ago, they will say, but the access,
You're only allowed to do the work that you previously could do. So, Mr. de Freitas, we are again asking for your striking off. You are not in accordance. Oh, but sir, we've got the rule in place because the NF made the rule. A rule is not as strong as an act, with all respect, Mr. Chair. That's in short. I think the biggest problem in this country is that we've got an English rose which we're trying to plant on an African tree. We got a double system inherited and we just want to keep it and keep it. The revolution thing would be, let's all be legal practitioners. Let's all do the same thing. Because, Mr. Chair, an attorney can do the exact same work that I'm doing. He is my competition, but I must keep out my beggar's hand and ask him for work. But he's my competition because in every court he's allowed to appear now. The difference between an attorney and advocate, Mr. Chair, has been eradicated. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's in short my reply.
What's your name?
Matthew Klein.
Thank you. Absolutely, that's me.
Okay.
All right. Ma'am, I'll start with you if you don't mind. To answer your question, I'll start with you first. I wasn't meant to be here. Michelle Bastieu, who's a coloured lady, who's the vice chair of our association, was meant to be here. Her dad's been admitted to hospital, diabetes, but he's level 2-9. I'm not quite sure what that means. I'm not a favour with that, but she was unable to be here. Something further as well. Matthew Klein, my colleague alongside me, is a white man. But this white man next to me established the first multiracial bar in South Africa. We've had so many testimonies of members telling us where they had to practice before, where they were unwelcome to practice at the general council of the bar because they happened to have a darker skin than everybody else that was there. Our association has got 90% people of color. And we've got members of all sexes, obviously. That's the way that it is. So that's the truth, that's reality. You're welcome to go to our website and you'll see this for yourself.
Because sometimes we are told that the transformation, you know, when we say black, we mean African, Indian, and colored.
Yes.
And people will go and bring colors and Indians and say they have met the criteria. And then it's still not acceptable because the most disadvantaged are African people.
Yeah. It's also disrespectful. If anybody could have window dressed here today, and I wouldn't be surprised if some delegates here haven't window dressed just because they've got to appear here. This forum is vital. It's important. As I've heard the members say here, it's been long in the making. This act has to be passed now. We must stop playing games. Matthew has just spoken a moment ago about the continuous conflict between the different bars because everybody's hanging on to the past all the time. And I agree with him. Why on earth are we playing games? I agree with Mr. Swart. If 30 years ago he had asked me the question that he did earlier on, I'd agree entirely with him. But I did not want to be an attorney. I wanted to be an advocate. You know why? Because I wanted to sit on the bench as a judge. And in those days, I was not allowed to if I was an attorney. So as a student, I worked exceptionally hard. I got an LLB. I didn't get a BProc, BUris, or any other lesser degree. I went for the best because I wanted to sit as a judge. But in 1994, the Appearance of Right in Court Act came about, where suddenly my competitor had the right to appear in the High Court, which was my domain. That's where I earned my living. And suddenly he's standing alongside me, and the rest is history. And slowly, 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 the attorneys have just been taking more and more unto themselves. And it's true. Today we have one legal qualification, a 4-year LLB. So why are we dividing people up into different sorts of classes? What's the gain by that?
You divide yourselves as lawyers if you fail to agree amongst yourselves.
That's true.
And then you come to Parliament,
yes,
with your disagreement. What do you expect Parliament to do?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to stick my neck out. This whole national forum thing is a sham, and let me tell you why.
First of all, I said to you how the playing field became undivided. I explained to you earlier on how the attorneys have gained the greater advantage. Because with the attorneys doing the nature of the work that they have been allowed to do in the past, advocates operated in the High Court predominantly, preparing papers, arguing before the High Courts, etc. We were a minority. What are the figures today? I think it's still reflective of it. We're about 4,000-6,000 advocates, over 20,000 attorneys. It takes about 4-5 law firms to support one advocate. But now the attorney doesn't need the advocate anymore. Now I know Mr. Horner that they mentioned about specialization. You don't have to be an attorney to be a specialist. You don't have to be an advocate to be a specialist. There are attorneys that have appeared before me that are better than advocates. That's not the issue. It's up to you how hard you're going to work at your trade. And you will then make a name for yourself, depending on your skill, your expertise, and the effort that you put into it. And what, now this national forum, the reason why I called it a sham, and I'll tell you why, clearly. You go into a fight, and Matthew described it. This has been a fight to date. But you're completely outnumbered. You've got a huge number of attorneys because they conveniently say, well, there's more of us, so automatically we've got to out-represent you. And you other groups, you're smaller, so we'll allocate less persons that can be on the board to represent. It's like getting into a fight with one hand behind your back in a blindfold. And you're meant to negotiate and have a proper fight with the guy on the other side. It doesn't work. Everything has been so worked out that the attorneys will always have the upper hand. Why? They will outvote everybody every time. That's my concern with the legal practice council that's coming along.
So you came to Parliament to make Parliament make a law which creates a sham, which means that we are collaborators in making laws which provide for shams, and that's why honourable members were saying you have to sort yourselves in the forum.
Sir, you will realise that the General Counsel of the Bar not here. I could be mistaken, but I don't see anybody here. They're not even interested in you. They're not interested in what's going on over here. They're not interested in coming at their viewpoint. They're not interested in dealing with this. This is
sorry, Chair, I think that's objectionable because they are represented on the forum. And I think that you need to keep your comments to the issues.
Let me
and
go
not
back
cast
to
aspersions on your fellow colleagues. That's not acceptable. The whole issue that we raised earlier is why aren't you as the forum reach an agreement to help us as Parliament deal with the issues.
So
now it's not correct to say that you are not, you've got different advocates institutions on that forum as well.
Yes.
The fact that you as advocates can't reach agreement is the first problem.
I agree with you.
No, but why? So Chair, I'm sorry, but I just wanted to interrupt on that issue.
I take your point.
Thanks for the intervention on the short proceed.
Oh, sorry, ma'am. Mr. Swart has just mentioned.
I think that people, let us just be fair. This organization is talking about what exactly this government wants to transform. Now to say that why don't you go with people who don't want transformation? Something is unfair. That's what I'm talking about. I mean, when it came, when you go to Canada, you've got one legal practitioner. You don't have this and that. So what I'm trying to say is that what they are saying is that they are actually assisting this government for to transform. That's what I'm saying. And we can't say, why then don't you bring people who don't want transformation?
We have you. We don't expect one size fits all. Let them finish what they are saying, but I think we are all entitled to our opinions and contributions. Proceed. And we don't have much time on our side.
I do agree with Mr. Swart, and the point that he raised is well taken. There are different advocate bodies on the National Forum. You've got advocates for transformation who are part of the General Council of the Bar. Then you have ourselves, and you have one or two other groups. I'm sorry, I don't know the names off the top right now. But these advocates are coming from different perspectives. And the reason why they are not having a meeting of the mind is because of their own personal interests. It doesn't, our association, we have one representative. We go to that forum. We raise our points. I think we only sit on one or two of about six committees. So we don't even have representation of the outcome because we're outnumbered. This is the frustration. How can we contribute if we can't sit there because we're outnumbered? So this is added to the difficulty of being at all the committees, being able to discuss all the issues that are necessary and are vital. And that's why I use the term, maybe harshly, when I use the term sham, because how can you say something if you're not entitled to be represented?
You see, my worry is amongst yourself as lawyers, you can agree, but you say the minister must decide in consultation with people who can agree amongst themselves, which means that government will not work. Maybe we must get paralegals and law students to come and assist you to move forward and take South Africa forward.
Any other contribution?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was we're thankful for having had the opportunity to talk here. And yes, the NF National Forum is doing a great job, but our little concern is where you put a rule which is not in the Act or on par with the Act. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry, can I just...
I think, Mr. Advocate De Freitas, without any disrespect to you, you see, you said the attorneys are outnumbering you. Now, you know that's not correct in terms of Section 96. There are eight attorneys, and there are five advocates, one advocate for the National Bar Council, one advocate for the National Forum of Advocates, and one advocate for the Advocates of Transformation. So it is eight and eight. The challenge that you point out is there isn't consensus amongst the different bodies, and I take that point. I think that's the high point of what you're saying.
Yes,
so I just wanted to correct that. But there seems to be, there's a lot of progress. And maybe, Chair, we need to have a report that is filed to the Minister as the progress that the forum has been made. There are one or two sticky issues, but it's going to be massively difficult. This fight has come 14 years. And so this issue that we're dealing with now is to give the forum a bit more time to finalize the issues. We can't go into all that battle again because it will mean a substantial amendment. It will mean the change of the whole Act. But the process that you were involved with when we drafted the Act, that whole process of the forum, then leading on to the council, is a process that was debated over a period of 10 years. You remember? You might not have always been involved in that. But I think at this stage, what you are dealing with is a very narrow amendment to help the minister finalize and give the forum additional time and to give the forum a bit more body to help you guys reach consensus. So I hope that is helpful. I don't mean any disrespect. Okay, thank you.
I think we need a national conference on transformation. We must bring the law student councils together, including other students in the humanities, because law is not just about rules. There are social workers, there are psychologists. How are they experiencing the law? Now we're dealing with law as if it's a technical matter, and the lawyers cannot agree for 20 years. This is not acceptable. And again, we have paralegals attached to LASA, and they're doing very well. And now we are delaying them in finalizing paralegal legislation. This is just not acceptable. So I think we will have to sit ourselves as a committee and map the way forward. But we thank you for accepting our invitation for coming here and making presentations. But we want to take South Africa forward. We want everybody who has a contribution to make this contribution. These law students are the practitioners of tomorrow. Their voice must be heard. They have insights that can take us forward. So also, we are in Africa. We need to have the African experience. We can't be told about Britain, the Welsh, we want to decolonize African legal systems because we are in Africa, and we want to make law accessible to African people. And for us, African people is all of us, black and white, that find themselves on this continent. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chase, thank you. May I be excused?
You are all excused.
Thank you. And yes, thanks. Bye.
Can I give you my address?
On behalf of the Paralegal Association.
Correct.
Okay, proceed. Honorable members, should you need some time to hear something? Proceed.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Delegates, I must say it's been a long time since I felt nervous or overwhelmed. I have done public speaking for many years, but on different forums and levels, and I'm in a room with many, many esteemed people. All right. The journey that brought me to be here is both a personal and a professional one, and I'm going to go into it all. And as I say, if I flounder a bit, just bear with me. I am aware of the overwhelmingness in the room. I was not party or privy to the previous hearings conducted in the compiling of this act, and more specifically those around the aspects of the paralegals. I am aware that there were certain presentations and discussions, and I can only go on what I've been informed of and discovered in my research. So I ask for indulgence where any of my presentation covers areas that maybe have been covered or possible incorrect information that I might be citing that I might have incorrect. I'm also a very new kid on the box, so to speak, and I'm still connecting with role players around South Africa on this issue. I am, my experience, as I said, has not been in the hallowed halls, but rather from the ground, which is what I've heard mentioned a few times today. I have reached where I am and come to be where I am here by being one of the people on the ground working and looking to make a difference and looking to assist in the areas where there have been gaps. My presentation is broad, as there are no sections in the actual act that I can specifically refer to because of the paralegals, so the act all refers to the legal attorneys, advocates, the bars, the councils. But I stated in my request for oral presentation that my research of the last 2 years in getting to this point of today has brought me to realizing why I feel that the paralegals need to be more recognized in the actual act. I am aware that there is work being done currently on the act and that the paralegal sections will be covered in the act. However, I feel that I wish to submit that there are aspects in the current LPA that will possibly prevent, limit, contradict, or deter the regulations of the paralegals to effectively occur. For ease of reference, after the presentation, I've numbered the sections I've referred to in the Act and the Bill, and the numbers, anybody who wants the presentation, I can email it to them because we had a bit of a copy issue, so we couldn't get enough copies up. But I will go on just now. In the actual chair, you have a copy. I have numbered sections next to the Act, and I will briefly go through them, why I feel it is relevant to looking at them from a viewpoint, a stand viewpoint of the paralegals and the Paralegal Act and regulations that needs to come. I've also attached various annexures to this presentation for the committee, and I'll touch on them briefly, as due to time restrictions, I will not spend much time on them. They are vast, and I've taken, it looks like they're vast, but I've taken a little bit of a lot, so as to get a broader picture of what I'm trying to achieve today. They will serve highlights and aspects of my presentation. I also, in line of this presentation, just wish to bring the definition to the word professional and practitioner. We have had earlier some definitions of the legal profession and the legal practitioner. However, the word professional and practitioner is very applicable to many other professions and to many other criteria. And the definition of the word professional, and I see I have a spelling mistake here, is relating or belonging to a profession. Clearly spelling isn't mine. Engaged in a specific activity as one man's occupation rather than as an amateur, or a person engaged in or qualified in a profession. And the definition of the word practitioner is someone practicing a skilled profession for which a special education or licensing is required, or one who practices something especially in an occupation, a profession, or a technique. What I'm going to do initially is just actually reference the Act and then the bill document, and as I said, the Chair has numbers, and I'm just going to very briefly read and touch on them because they are specifically relevant to all the bodies that have been here, but I want you to look at them from the eyes of how I'm bringing it in from a paralegal's eyes. So it says, the Act is to provide a legislative framework for the transformation and restructuring of the legal profession in line with constitutional imperatives so as to facilitate and enhance an independent legal profession that broadly reflects the diversity and the demographics of the Republic, to provide for the establishment, powers, functions of a single South African Legal Practice Council and provincial councils, and in order to regulate the affairs of legal practitioners and to set norms and standards to provide for the admission and enrollment of legal practitioners, to regulate the professional conduct of legal practitioners so as to ensure accountable conduct, to provide for the establishment of an office of the legal service ombuds, and for the appointment, power, and functions of a legal services ombud, to provide for legal practitioners to list, and then it goes on, which is not relevant. It then goes in the preamble, which refers to Section 22 of the Constitution, refers to freedom of trade. If we also, at very briefly, without going into it, refer to Section 34 and 38 of the Constitution, which Section 34 says access to courts. Everyone has the right to have any dispute that can be resolved by the application of law decided in a fair public hearing before a court or, where appropriate, another independent and impartial tribunal or forum. I will touch on this a bit more just now, but as we know, more and more people today are starting to represent themselves in court for a variety of reasons, which I'll touch on, and it is their right, but it is also causing frustrations for the court and very often situations for the person themselves who is getting layman advice from a variety of places. Section 38 of where it refers to enforcing of rights, it touches on that any person may approach a court or anyone acting in their own interest, acting on behalf of another person who cannot act in their own name, anyone acting as a member of or in the interest of a group or class of persons, anyone acting in the public interest, and an association taking in the interest of members. And the important word that comes up a lot there is anyone. Then if we carry on the preamble, I mean, you are all, I'm sure, very, very aware of the wording, but I just, again, want you to look at it from the viewpoint of the discussions that have come up of needing to bring the paralegals into this umbrella of the law world and the judiciary. So we have words, the legal profession is regulated by different laws. And if we think of where we know so many of the paralegals act, especially in rural areas and communities, there are a lot of different aspects that affect them there. Access to legal services is not a reality for most South Africans. And I will touch on this a little bit more just now as to why we have so many independent paralegals trying to fill that gap. Opportunities for entry into the legal profession are restricted in terms of the current legislative framework. As far as the paralegal aspect goes, that applies very much. And in order to, it then goes on to say, into a profession which is broadly representative of the public's demographic under a single regulatory body. And I want to highlight single regulatory body because I'm going to come back to that later, because I really feel that the one thing that has been missing from this entire situation is that the paralegals need to form part of the entire situation, of the act, of the councils, and I will touch on a bit later why. Ensure that the values underpinning the Constitution are embraced. Ensure that legal services are accessible. Remove any unnecessary artificial barriers for entry into the legal profession. Ensure the accountability of the legal profession to the public. If I then go on, we have the application of the Act. Again, the purpose of the Act, it clearly speaks of framework for the transformation and restructuring of the legal profession that embraces the values underpinning the Constitution and ensures the rule of law is upheld, broadens access to justice, a mechanism determining the fees, we're all aware of what they say, rendered are within the reach of citizenry, measures to provide for the rendering of community service by, and here's where we start, candidate legal practitioners and practicing legal practitioners. I will touch on those words a bit more later as they come up regularly through the Act. They regularly refer to junior attorneys or candidate attorneys. Measures that provide equal opportunities, and again, equal opportunities for all aspirant legal practitioners in order to have a legal profession that broadly reflects the demographic of the Republic. We go on to all legal practitioners and all candidate legal practitioners in pursuit of the goal of an accountable, efficient, independent legal profession. Protect and promote the interest of the public. Again, right of appearance of legal practitioners and, again, candidate legal practitioners. I'm going to keep highlighting that because I'm going to reference why I highlight that later. Section 33, authority to render legal services. Everyone is well aware of this Act, and I believe that it had a fair amount of debating. Where I think it is important, without me wasting more time, is where it refers to these functions that can only be carried out by certain legal practitioners that are cited, where it may only be for remuneration, fees, commission, or reward or gain. I just want to keep in mind the words reward or gain, which I will also touch on a bit later. We do have, as we all know, that it says in Section 34.9, the Council must, within 2 years after the commencement of Chapter 2 of this Act, investigate and make recommendations to the Minister on the creation of other forms of legal practice, including limited liability legal practices, multidisciplinary practices, and the statutory recognition of paralegals. Taking into account best international practices, the public interest, and the interest of the legal profession, with a view to legislative and other interventions in order to improve access to legal profession and access to the justice generally. I am also going to touch on later, which I believe the Chair did, that should also include the best country practices, what's best for us in Africa, what's best for ourselves. There are other African countries who I am going to cite just now who have also addressed the paralegal issues, but many of the African countries have different challenges, and I think we need to look at what ours in South Africa are as well. And then if I look at Chapter 4, which is the Code of Conduct, which I won't go into, I just wanted to highlight it because I again will touch on it later, because currently there is absolutely no Code of Conduct for paralegals. If we look at the current bill, where again it says to provide that only practicing legal practitioners may perform certain acts or render certain services to further regulate, and it then goes on to say, to further provide their functions of the national forum of the legal profession. So I just wanted to highlight all of that so that the rest of what I'm going to sort of say now makes a bit more sense. So I also had very short notice to prepare and everything, so I try to take all my points and put them in order, and eventually when the brain boggled, I decided to just comment on the point.
I think you have made your point, because what we require now is not a justification for paralegal legislation. There has to be a recognition of paralegal. The paralegal legislation must be passed, and I was personally very, very impressed with the South African delegation that was at the Kigali Conference. They were so articulate in front of judges they made their case, and there were experiences from Mozambique. Mozambique is very much advanced in this area. Zimbabwe is very much advanced. And if we had sought the experiences of our neighboring countries, we would not be where we are now. So I think that you are well prepared, you are making your point, but you know, we no longer want justification. We want legislation, paralegal legislation. We want the paralegals to step in, because our people must have access to justice. Justice is not a nice to have. It's something that people must access.
Chair, you're correct, and I the point was not to justify it, was that I realized that there have been, during my research of the last 2 years, that there have been bones of contention of this issue from various aspects. So I merely wanted to re-highlight that when my closing now is very short.
Contentions are because of business interests.
All right.
Because
well, then
law,
let me carry on.
Law has become a business. People are making money out of it, and that's why things become contentious.
Then
for
I will
us,
carry on.
Law is about making justice accessible, not about business.
All right. Then, as I said, my current points now are in no particular order, so they are just points highlighting. Okay. Pelsey is of the opinion that paralegals should not be seen separate as to the LPA or the Act or the Bill. They are a vital and integral part of the judicial and legal world. We would not manage efficiently without them. They are hand and glove and not hand and shoe. There is a difference between a proper, fully experienced paralegal and a legal secretary and a legal assistant. Currently, they are all seen as employees. It is a fact and a well-known one that a very large number of paralegals operating independently across South Africa. They are doing so mostly with a heart-driven, but often lacking in skills and experience. They would perform much better if they had the proper training and ability to seek for support and or be monitored. This has been born out of a dire need for legal assistance to many, both in the local and rural communities, as well as to people who cannot afford the fees of an attorney, i.e. a divorce matter can often be handled by a paralegal, and yet even cheaper. Attorneys will cost several thousands rands to perform the same function. I have used this as an example, as one can easily today do one's own divorce through the courts with the assistance of the clerk. But it would be important to still have proper guidance. The training institutions are aware of this and even promote this aspect, filling their classrooms and taking fees for this. I myself applied for and studied at a very expensive paralegal training with UCT, offered a paralegal practitioner course, and whose pamphlets even referred to being able to be a freelance paralegal. Yet, this is incorrect. It would be best served to regulate and address the aspect and do so under the same umbrella. Many countries have addressed this issue by allowing a practice number to be allocated to paralegals. They have certain criteria met. In some countries, they can even open their own practice. We in South Africa are lagging far behind the aspect of addressing our paralegal situation. There is a vast difference between a senior paralegal who has worked for many years and a legal secretary or legal assistant. In many firms, the senior paralegal is in fact the person who often manages various aspects of the practice, including the managing and guiding of candidate attorneys. Paralegals should have the representation on the new council again, as they are a vital and integral part of the system, exposing to and operating in almost all aspects of laws where attorneys and advocates and courts are working. The studies available for paralegals, while offered by many institutions, are, and very expensive, vary from a few weeks to 2 years, but yet they are all considered paralegals. There is nothing to regulate them, and since my timing is coming short, I will cut points down. I feel that the Department of Higher Education needs to be involved in order to have a formula and a stable paralegal training program. There can be a junior one, there can be a senior one, there can be a variety, but at the moment, the paralegal training programs are all vastly different. A lot of people are going to Boston College, getting a 6-month paralegal certificate, and going into rural areas and operating as paralegals. Their hearts are in the right place. They have no skills and no experience to go and perform this. We need to address this. Just as candidate attorneys need to go through the practical skills, we should also look at some form of practical training for paralegals, especially those who want to become independent. Paralegals are more in tune on the ground, and they are very often able to perform in issues and areas where even junior attorneys often aren't able to get there. The Act often refers to the word candidate attorneys. I wish to submit that on many terms that a candidate attorney is far less experienced and knowledgeable than a senior paralegal. And very often senior paralegals are able to do far more or equal work to what junior attorneys or candidate attorneys are doing. I will also want to point out that the form of remuneration commission or gain, which even refers to the drawing of documents, currently paralegals are being paid. Currently, volunteers get a reward.
Okay. We need actually this class. We should just be using the time to make some money from it. But we are concerned about the people who really need access to that. Honorable members,
law is not about rules. Law is about people. And we need to reach a stage where we say our lawyers have mastered rules. They apply rules. But the people that need access, they need services of social workers, psychologists, and so on. So they need people like you who have a holistic approach to life. So can we open the floor for honorable members to engage?
You said we need not participate in making the legal fraternity an unstable place. What is important currently is that we must get the legislation. Get the legislation that also seeks to standardize what these people are doing. But maybe as a committee, or maybe we must go on a study tour to one of the countries that we have mentioned, so that if the executive does not fast track this matter, or those as they are still fighting, we can come up with a committee bill as soon as this year. And so that we come up with a committee bill, we fast track the issue of the paralegal, because they too, there's no framework against which they are working. And that it may create even amongst themselves the same problem that we have with the other practitioners. So I think we've got to do a lot of work in terms of making sure that we finalize this matter actually before the end of the year, because that's what is required even by the Principal Act. And now we're amending this one. We're making this bill, but we have not yet implemented certain things that we ought to have done in terms of the main one. So what I was saying is that we need to fast track this matter. I think it's a matter that is part of our program, that that legislation must be there.
I agree with you, Honorable. The Mozambicans are very advanced on this. They are just less than 3 hours drive to go to Mozambique. And from here, from South Africa. From South Africa. From here in South Africa. So I agree with you. We can go to Mozambique and Zimbabwe and come back with a bill. You can comment later after the spoke. Honorable John.
Thank you, Chair. My question is a simple question, whether we could just be advised as to what are expected of Parliament to do now in respect of this amendment bill that we are dealing with. That was unfortunately not quite clear from the presentation. Thank you.
Any other comments?
Honorable Mpumulana.
I would only say that it's important to have paralegals not to be para anymore. To encourage them to be legal, not more than para. But anyway, we one thing that I think you really have the support of the Congress. But mainly, you need to push for the act. Thank you.
I think he was also write a book. From 1986, the University of South Africa, the University of Cape Town, has done a lot of work on in this area, community courts and things like that. We need alternative literature dealing with these things. Now, I think honorable members are right to say, now we want a piece of legislation on the table. We don't want to be dealing with the pros and cons. But we really appreciate the good work that we have done. I think we will appreciate that this committee is going to start to bring this committee.
I'll just quickly answer, yes. I just want to say that due to timing, some of the issues that I wanted to raise were not able to happen, but yes, there has been a vast, one of the things that was in my presentation is that because of this gap that exists for a profession of which there are thousands in South Africa at the moment, be they employed, be they in advice offices, be they in courts, be they in unions, what has happened is a large group of bodies, each working with different paralegal aspects, have formulated themselves, or some bodies have started working with, like a university will open an advice office and manage it. And then often the candidate attorneys or the paralegals will run in the advice office, but a lot of the advice offices have run into problems, be it funding, be it managing, be it a variety of issues. There has been a certain, that I've discovered in the last 2 years, there has been a certain amount of, exactly as I think the Honourable Mbongo pointed out, that there has been a very similar fighting and elitism and autonomism that I have discovered in the last 2 years of researching this. Because there has been no governing or regulating of it, you've had groups who have taken it on themselves to do it, and it has worked in that fish pond. You have the big fish in that fish pond, but it has been separate from the whole picture. To answer his question, the reason I did this presentation, and I feel strongly about it, is even if we do the Paralegal Act, which everyone keeps referring to, if the Paralegal Act says a legal practitioner may do this and this and this, but this act says nobody else but an attorney and an advocate may do this, you have a contradiction of the two acts. And this is going to be the issue. A lot of this act refers to only certain professional people may do certain things, which will make anything you say in the Paralegal Act moot, because it won't be able to happen because this act will stop it from happening.
We are not lawmakers, don't worry. We're dealing with that. We are lawmakers. The Banking Association of South Africa.
Talk to principles, not to details and sections and things.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members of Parliament and fellow presenters. Thank you all for this opportunity. By way of introduction, my name is Aisha Hansa and I will take you through a few preliminary points which contextualises our presence here today as BASA. I will then hand over to my colleague Albert. As you can see from the first slide, which we'll get to, the Banking Association, which I will refer to as BASA from time to time in the presentation, is the industry representative body for banks consisting of 32 member banks, both local and international. BASA understands and supports the government's initiative, as well as the department's intended reforms as contained in the Legal Practice Act, as well as in the Amendment Bill, and are generally comfortable, save for the few points raised herein. We trust that our comments may add value to the drafting process in respect of the Amendment Bill. In order to understand why we sit before the Portfolio Committee today, we need to take a step back in the Attorneys Act, which defined practitioner as an attorney duly admitted to practice as an attorney. The Act then went on to focus on what is required for an attorney to be admitted, enrolled, and then practice as such for the purposes of rendering legal advice to the public, and paid little or no attention to non-practicing attorneys. The preamble to the Legal Practice Act, in broad terms, sets out the following objective: to regulate the professional conduct of legal practitioners so as to ensure accountable conduct in order to, one, restructure it to be broadly representative of demographics, two, regulate the legal profession in the public interest, three, remove artificial barriers of entry to the legal profession, and four, ensure the accountability of the legal profession to the public. The LPA seeks to do this by removing the fragmented and divided approach which was inherited through the previous Attorneys Act. These objectives are vital, important, and welcomed by all practitioners, including the Corporate Counsel represented by BASA. Our concern, however, is that the legislation did not go into a lot of detail around non-practicing attorneys in the Act, a fact which we believe the Amendment Bill seeks to further clarify with reference to specific sections that are limited to practicing legal practitioners. In BASA's view, neither the Act nor the Amendment Bill seek to regulate the professional conduct of corporate counsel. It is only in the reading the Code of Conduct that was recently published by the National Forum that BASA began engaging with its members to try and understand the source of regulating the affairs of corporate counsel. In terms of the Act, the definition of legal practitioner means an advocate or attorney admitted and enrolled as such in terms of Sections 24 and 30 respectively. I apologize for my section references. The role means role of legal practitioners, referred to in Section 30 sub 3. When one looks at the subsection concerned, especially Section 30, it's apparent that a person can only practice as a legal practitioner if he or she is admitted and enrolled to practice as such. The counsel is then tasked to keep a role that must reflect the particulars of practicing and non-practicing legal practitioners. This indicates a clear appreciation that a distinction needs to be drawn between practicing and non-practicing attorneys. However, BASA's understanding is that a reference to non-practicing legal practitioner in this manner does not necessarily mean that the purpose of the Act is to regulate the affairs of and professional conduct of corporate counsel. Chapter 3 of the Act, being on the next slide, focuses on the role of practicing legal practitioners, again indicative of those who render legal advice to the public. For example, 34 sub 1 states that an attorney may render legal services in expectation of any fee, commission, gain, or reward upon receipt of a request directly from the public for that service. Again, 34 5 says that the legislature listed the manner in which an attorney or advocate can practice, limited to 5 instances, none of which include working for a private corporate entity as corporate counsel. Chapter 4 of the Act deals with professional conduct and establishment of disciplinary bodies, and in the main is directed at legal practitioners, correctly so, and in BASA's view, limited to practicing legal practitioners in the manner in which it regulates their affairs. This contemplates a code of conduct being published by the counsel once established. The Act, however, in Chapter 10, made provision for another code of conduct that has been published by the National Forum, and it's the first time that the term legal practitioners who are not in private practice / corporate counsel arises, with the resulting consequence that the Code in Counts 2 and 7 regulates the affairs and professional conduct of corporate counsel. The challenge for BASA is trying to understand, one, how the Counsel Code of Chapter 4 and, two, the National Forum Code of Chapter 10 will work together, and whether non-compliance will result in disciplinary measures imposed under Chapter 4. Based on BASA's understanding of the limited application of the Act to non-practicing legal practitioners by virtue of the role that must be kept, there was no real concern until the Code was published. Because it is unclear if the Code can be tied back to Chapter 4 of the Act, and reference has to be given, for example, to how the disciplinary body is constituted, no mention is made to having a non-practicing legal practitioner who is a corporate counsel present as part of the panel. Why? We believe once again that this is because the Act never contemplated regulating the affairs of corporate counsel. Another example from Chapter 5, relevant to BASA, is the operation of the legal ombud versus that of the banking ombud, as decisions in respect of banking customers may have had legal input from corporate counsel, and that decision is then taken by the customer to the banking ombud. I guess it also serves to illustrate that the public interest aspect is already covered by ombuds who operate in the relevant industry in which corporate counsel functions. So it becomes a challenge to try and understand the role of the legal ombud should the term legal practitioner be interpreted widely to include corporate counsel. The principles set out in the code per se are not an issue, and it outlines the same ethics and practices that we as corporate counsel adhere to and demand of the corporate counsel that are employed by the banks and which form part of our employer's policies and procedures. We have reached out and are trying to engage with the National Forum on the code in order to understand its application and scope. Barca is of the view that the legislature appreciated why the professional conduct of corporate counsel should not fall to be governed by the Act or any code, and unless the Act is amended to incorporate corporate counsel, then strictly speaking, corporate counsel are regulated through their employers. I'm going to hand over to my colleague Albert just to take you through a few of the specifics.
I think it's important to note what we're dealing with is a few examples of why we feel that the Act doesn't sufficiently make provision, therefore, that the professional conduct of corporate counsel should not be regulated by it. Further examples is that if you once look at the composition of the legal counsel that's going to come into being, as well as the National Forum, corporate counsel doesn't enjoy any representation on those bodies, and therefore we have not been able to give any input in the work on the National Forum over the past how many years on how the Act and codes of conduct should apply to us. If one also looks at other areas of the Act, in the constitution of provisional councils, it makes provision, therefore, that provisional councils can have subcommittees to look after attorneys and advocates' professions. It doesn't mention corporate counsel at all. So corporate counsel represents a material constituency of the legal profession. And despite this, the Act makes no mention of corporate counsel and does not grant any representation of corporate counsel on the various bodies. There are a few practical issues that we sit with as the Act is currently written, and which, if we have to interpret that it does apply to us, that will be what we call unintended consequences. Many legally qualified corporate counsel are not advocate attorneys or advocates. You get vastly experienced legal qualified people who has worked in big corporations or small corporations for many years and are very good at what they do. But according to how the Act is written currently, they would not fall under the definition of a legal practitioner. And the question then becomes whether the Act's intention is to exclude that constituency from its regulation, or does the Act intend to tell them that they are not supposed to call themselves a legal practitioner and by subsequently a corporate counsel? Section 33.2, for example, says no legal practitioner can hold him or herself out to be a legal practitioner if he or she is not qualified as such. Would that then mean that those corporate counsel who have been internal legal advisors for many years but is not admitted attorneys or advocates, are they able to continue doing what they're doing? A big part of the purpose of the Act includes protecting the interests of the general public, which is important. Corporate counsel's only client, I think for us, which is important to realize, is their employer. We do not render legal services to the general public. And therefore, the question is who needs protection from the services that we render? We are subject to our employer's disciplinary and ethical codes. We are, in a lot of instances, subject to industry codes like the highly regulated financial services and particularly banking industry, which we have to adhere to. So those mechanisms are in place to regulate our conduct. The question is, we do not think that the public needs, or that is a view,
needs extensive protection against what we do, because we interact with them as employees of our employers, and not as a, not, we don't render legal services to them. We are also subject to our employers' disciplinary codes. I've mentioned that. And the next question also then becomes is the jurisdiction of the legal ombud. Again, the legal ombud is supposed to, or as I understand from the Act, the legal ombud can investigate misconduct by legal practitioners and complaints made by the public. And Chapter 5 states the objects of the legal ombud is to protect and promote public interest in relation to the rendering of legal services, and also to investigate complaints of misconduct against legal practitioners. For us, that is, the application of that to us is very uncertain. If I represent my employer in an interaction with a member of the public, I act as an employee, I don't act as a legal professional. Would that member of the public then be able to approach that ombud as opposed to the banking ombud or any other ombud, industry ombud, to regulate my conduct? The intention of the conduct, in our view, is clearly to regulate legal practice and not legal practitioners. So it's what legal practitioners do that's regulated, and what the ombud should look at, not necessarily at what we do. A further practical issue is a lot of corporate counsel, a big part of the work that they do is not the rendering of legal services. They are involved in risk management, compliance, company secretarial work, even project management, and some of them even get involved in transactional and business transactions of their employers. So the question is it the Act, the Legal Practice Act's role and place to regulate that conduct? Because it's not clear from the Act what conduct of a corporate counsel will be regulated by the Act, and what the ombud and the disciplinary structures would have jurisdiction over. Our submissions on the proposed amendment in Section 3 of the Bill, where there's a further attempt, in our view, to make a distinction between practicing legal practitioner and non-practicing legal practitioners, do not go far enough to provide clarity and certainty for corporate counsel as a part of the legal profession in understanding what the application of the Act in their roles are. We are of the view that for the Act to properly address corporate counsel's position and their professional conduct, there need to be more substantial changes to the Act, and maybe an express mention of them, their role, and the legal services they render to properly do that. We also need to mention that I've made the point that we are not represented on the national forum. We are also not going to be represented on the legal council. In our view is that if the Act seeks to regulate our professional conduct through a formal code of conduct, then at least we should be represented on those structures, and even more so on the disciplinary structures that has been established. Because there's also good examples there where if an attorney is brought before the disciplinary committees, there must be an attorney on the disciplinary committee, obviously to take into consideration the nuances of the attorney's profession. If a corporate counsel were to be brought before a disciplinary hearing and there would be no representative, and corporate counsels have got its own unique nuances and context in which it operates, and that's the point we would like to make there. I think what the important point that we, Mr. Chairman, what we want to make is we understand that this bill has been, or the Act has been, a few years in the making. And it might seem that we've come to the party late. However, the publication of the Code of Conduct actually caused us to have a closer look at the Act, because I think, I don't want to make it too strong a point, but the general feeling was that the Act regulates us insofar as the following. It says these are the things that a legal practitioner may do. So if you, as a legally qualified person, do those things, if I give myself out to go and represent people in court and appear, I accept, as a non-practicing legal practitioner, I accept that I can get into trouble for that. However, it doesn't go beyond that and saying, however, that work that you do for your employer, I'm going to regulate that and how you do it. And that's, I think, is there anything else? That's
yeah, you have anything to say?
Sorry, Onguchi, I didn't hear.
I said, do you want to add something?
No, that's good, thank you.
You see, the frustration that you are expressing just shows that our problem is that people look at law simply in business, through business eyes. There's no social conscience. There's no public interest law conscience. So I think we must agree with the law students that we must decolonize the law. Lawyers must be forced to have a social conscience through the change of the curriculum, and there must be a development of a public interest law, which was developed from the 80s, and it was abandoned by the self-interest by the lawyers. So we have had it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can we, the honorable members are happy and very clear. Honorable Duma?
I just want to find out what the corporate counsel are when you are saying they are not admitted advocates or attorneys, and yet they need to be recognized separately like legal paralegals. What exactly are you saying? If I've got a law degree and just get employed, I must also not be recognized as such. Is that what is being said? And I think that why can't these people just enter one of the profession or the other? Legal practitioner.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to get some further information or clarity in that the arguments made that Part 7 of the Code of Conduct applies to corporate counsel. If we can just be advised as to what the reasons is. Reasons are why the banking association feels that way. To my mind, it's not that explicitly stated. But if they can advise, it would be welcome.
Do you want to respond to the truth?
Thank you, honourable members. The first point I would just like to clarify is that corporate counsel simply means this. A corporate counsel is a legal professional who is employed by an employer and renders his or her legal services solely for that employer. Those people might have been attorneys or advocates who were admitted as such and practiced, but they are now employed to render their services to the employer for various reasons. It might be more cost effective if there's a big volume of work. But some of them are employed as corporate counsel, and so the traditional term is a legal advisor. Some of them are employed by employers. They might not have been admitted attorneys or advocates, but they draft.
But they practice law.
Yes.
So,
Honourable, I can assure you that I'm an admitted attorney and I have colleagues experienced and knowledgeable than me in certain areas of the law, and they are only qualified. They've never been admitted as an expert. Because
they're practicing law. Take a narrow interpretation of legal practice. Legal practice is not just appearing in court. So, can you deal with that?
Now, that relates to that approach to legal practitioners.
Pardon?
Sorry, Jay, if I may. I mean, that relates to it. You've now accused me of following a narrow interpretation.
No,
well, indeed, that might be the case. In the sense that, the way I understand it, this would only apply to corporate counsel who are also non-practicing attorneys and advocates. Or don't you see it that way?
And that's part of the practical difficulty we have with the current wording of the Act, is that if the Act is supposed to apply to our profession, which is corporate counsel, it will only apply to those individuals who have been admitted as an advocate or as an attorney, and not to those who may have rendered legal services for many years to their employers. So they would not be subject to the provision of the Act, and so there's a disjoint in that.
May I have a follow-up?
Yes.
Okay. You say you're an admitted attorney, and this Act goes towards professionals. Now, when we did our articles, we had to also pass that part of the exam about legal practice and ethics. And then we were told that for you to be a professional, you must pass the entrance exam and enroll in the professional body. So wouldn't that be the distinction as to why the code of conduct must apply to corporate counsel who are also legal practitioners? So in that, ultimately the counsel cannot regulate people who only went through the trouble of obtaining a law degree but do not qualify to be deemed as professionals in law.
So, can I ask you, answer, Honourable Member, your first question on the code of conduct in Chapter 7? There's already been a code of conduct issued that governs corporate counsel's conduct in February this year. I think as I understand your question correctly, is
does ethics apply to corporate?
Apart from the fact that the Act never sought to regulate other people than legal practitioners.
Okay, let's accept that the Act never sought to do that, but from your account, it's quite clear that that's a limited application of the Act, so you are seeking an extension to incorporate corporate rights, so the point has been taken.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I'm a bit disturbed by the contribution from. Does it mean that if I can fly this thing that we use when we come here, and I don't have the necessary documentation for it, but because I can do it, then I must do it and be taken as such? I think then there will be serious corruption that is taking place that needs serious investigation, because what qualifies somebody is the things that you are able to produce. The fact that I'm an expert in speaking, may, for instance, does not qualify me to be a communication specialist. But a communication specialist will be a person who will come here with the document over and above being good communicator. Here, the document that certifies somebody with authority must be able to certify you to be able to take a particular job or a particular. But if we're going to be saying an account, somebody opens an account, does not meet the minimum requirements. The minimum requirements that is that being you must be, other than the LLP that we have, over and above you must have X, Y, Z, which is stated in the in the legislation. But
Honorable Bongo, if you listen to the heading, it says there are also people who have been admitted before, but who are now, who were admitted attorneys or advocates, who are now corporate lawyers. So how, where do you draw the distinction?
That was the second.
So your point, I hear your point, but the problem is that among the corporate lawyers, there are those who have the papers that are there now.
Do they comply with the other requirements of having the fidelity?
The fidelity certificate would not be relevant there because they are not handling public funds. Honorable Majaki.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the legislation that is before us is about regulating the legal profession. And when you're actually saying that with corporate counsel, there are those that don't have legal qualifications. It means it's something that almost falls out of what we are actually looking at now. And what Honorable Bongo is actually alluding to is something that needs to be looked at. In terms of regulation of this area of work. And you've actually indicated that the Code of Ethics has just been adopted early this year to actually regulate corporate counsel. But I think it's things like this that actually now needs to be looked at. But for us to be focused for now, with this legislation that's before us, it's actually looking at regulation of the legal profession in terms of people who are actually qualified to be lawyers.
Honorable Bongwen, you are right. The problem is that it took this parliament more than 15 years to work on this piece of legislation. So they are assisting us to look at all areas because there is enough, a lot of work to be done. We can't be amending the same piece of legislation every year. Otherwise, your points are valid. But you see, your contribution helps this parliament to really look at things holistically. Because it's long that parliament has worked on this piece of legislation. Honorable Mulan will be the last.
I thought that if you are admitted as an attorney and you are practicing corporate world, you are a practicing attorney. Even if you are not independent or employed, you are a practicing attorney. And are you not governed by the ethics of the law society or wherever? Now we are going to go to we are driving towards having one legal practitioner, whether you are an attorney or an advocate, but you are a legal practitioner. So if you decide you're not going to stand on your own, you're going to practice, what's the difference? But I'm worried about having somebody, like I would have go and study medicine, and I don't really finish up, I do the 6 year, but I don't do the practical or whatever. Now I go and practice medicine. And I'm a corporate medical practitioner. Now, I'm not trying to ridicule what you're saying, but I'm trying to understand that here is a guy who is experienced and they've been doing this thing for a long time. But who's controlling this guy? Yeah, sorry. Who's controlling him? That is the problem. But anyway, I get your point, sir. I'll really seriously think about it. Thank
you. One will be a paramedic. Let's leave it. Thank you. Now, I think we should really leave it there. You have made your point, and then you have a way to tender for other aspects that we have needed as well.
Thank you very much.
The National Forum on Legal Profession.
Chairperson, the honourable member has not spoken today. Is it really fair to the committee? He's on